This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Kyle Johnson says the blind are ironically often invisible, and he wants Floridians to recognise what they have to offer the community. Johnson steps into the role of CEO at Lighthouse Central Florida next month. He wants to raise the profile of blind and visually impaired Central Floridians and grow Lighthouse's business that employs the visually impaired. Among the things that Lighthouse employees do, package medical supplies for the federal government for combat medic kits. And if you bought a magic band for a visit to Disney World recently, the box it came in was built by someone from Lighthouse. Kyle Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So you've been testing this out for a little while Lee Nasahi is sort of transitioning out of the position. What have you learnt about Lighthouse, and what do you think the goals you will have come January 1st will be?
You know, our five-year strategic plan is going to remain the same, you know, and that's, to put it simply, Matthew, it's to help more people in better ways faster. You know, we're helping roughly 600 Central Floridians at Lighthouse Central Florida each year, where there could be 50 to 80,000 people who would qualify for our services just in the Tri-County.
So you're trying to increase the number of people you're helping?
Certainly, and the ways that we're helping people. You know, we've got Lighthouse Central Florida, which is the social, you know, nonprofit where if you're born blind or become so in any stage or visually impaired, we're the only organization in Central Florida that is there to serve. But we've also got a social enterprise nonprofit company called Lighthouse Works that's going into our eighth year of business. And that's where we have multiple business lines. We're doing real business for real customers, but 94%, right now 94%, it wavers, but it's typically over 90%. Of the direct labor being performed by people who are blind or visually impaired.
So we can talk about that in a moment, but let me just go back to the sort of bread and butter of what you do. How do you help the folks that you help?
We work in the space of vision rehabilitation services. So the American Academy of Ophthalmology has said that vision rehabilitation is part of standard of care. So if you get a diagnosis that says you're severely visually impaired or blind, it is part of standard of care to refer to an agency like Lighthouse Central Florida. So we work with birth through the end of life. So you've got the goals for a child who's between birth and 5 years old is going to be vastly different than, say, someone who's 35 or 41 like I am. So in each of those different age groups, you've got different objectives you need to work through, and that's what we do each day. A great example of that is, you know, if you think of a child who's one and then you think of them at two, how very different they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so where our goal there with the babies and toddlers is to help them go through every developmental milestone you and I went through by the age of five so that they emerge having gone through each of those milestones, having done it themselves, having learned through the gift of failure, and being capable, competent kids who are ready to be lifelong learners. And that is dramatically going to impact their likelihood that they're going to be educated, employable adults in our community rather than relying on our community their whole lives.
So are you providing resources, like would it be teaching or Braille materials, for example?
That's part of what we do, yeah. Mm-hmm. Technology is a big part of their lives. But also, too, you know, with a child, that's learning social cues, like turning and looking at the person you're talking to, the alphabet, mathematics, you know. And independent living skills are big. Mobility, moving about our community or their homes competently, safely, and independently. So it really is stem to stern. Everything that you and I learned by the age of five or by the age that we are today has got to be learned. Just the approach to those aspects are going to be sometimes vastly different.
And you know? How do you do it? Like, are you putting somebody in the home of somebody who has visual impairment to help them out?
We do. So we do a lot of itinerant work for younger children. We go out to their home, their school, their most common learning environments. And we're primarily working with also the parents, whoever's caring for that child, to teach them how to do it as well, giving them the vocabulary and the techniques to teach the child. And then, you know, everywhere from we have seniors who are coming every day to Lighthouse Central Florida and learning how to cook in a kitchen with sharp knives and hot ovens and move about the world and go to Publix and learn everything from that to iPhones and Android devices and how to take their lives in their own hands and live independently.
Mm-hmm. I guess there's plenty of examples, or there's at least some pretty well-known examples of people who've overcome a visual impairment and they've gone on to excel in arts or other things.
Mm-hmm.
Does that kind of skew the image for people who aren't visually impaired of you know what the possibilities are? Do you think a little bit?
I think so. We've a pretty mysterious population that we're working with. You know, like I said, there are 50 to 80,000 in Central Florida. How often are you running into people who are blind or visually impaired in the community? And a big reason for that is, you know, for someone like you or I to go blind, we tend to isolate.
Sure.
We become block locked because.
So you're saying you might not be running into them because they're staying home. They're not getting out.
That's right. Yeah. Are you going to cross Colonial blind if you've never been taught to do so? Right. So it does skew.
Crossing Colonial, even with fully sighted and visual, is tricky, right?
Or most sure streets I in do Central that. Florida. Yeah. But folks do sort of that. It's an invisible cause, right? Who's going to go to work and say, you know, I just got a diagnosis and I'm going blind? People tend to keep that pretty close to the vest. But the fact of the matter is, we live in a society, in many ways, for this reason, where stigma, pity, fear, where it limits our what we think is capable for somebody who's blind. And there's something I call the humanity gap, mm-hmm. and that's that. If we're unfamiliar with blindness, we tend to see a person who's blind and we think we feel sorry for them or uncomfortable around them. Or, to your point, we go, wow, that, you know, Eric Weinmeier climbed Mount Everest and he's blind. Mm-hmm. But in both of those cases, we aren't identifying with them. We see a blind person, not a person who's got life experience, academic experience, professional experience, who happens to be blind. And so for the last 42 years at Lighthouse Central Florida, we've been applying process technology and training to equalize that scenario for these folks. And then at Lighthouse Works, we apply that to help people have thriving new careers.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. We're talking to Kyle Johnson. He's the incoming CEO of Lighthouse. It's an advocacy organization for the visually impaired in Central Florida. So tell me about that. Part of what you do is helping to reorient people for careers if they're visually impaired or just help them do better at what they're doing. What are some of the things you do to do that?
Well, at Lighthouse Central Florida, our core mission, we have supported employment and vocational rehabilitation training. So we're helping them learn how to be back in the workforce and skill explore. Perhaps I was a carpenter and I can't go back and do that. Well, what mm-hmm. can I do? And we see people transition into the tech field and whatnot. But at Lighthouse Works, this is a social enterprise company that is designed to achieve two things. One, create revenue that we can send to Lighthouse Central Florida and help pay our own way in the community. So we do rely on philanthropy, but we're doing something about that ourselves by generating revenue.
Are you kind of revenue neutral or whatever the expression would be? Like, can you sustain what you do without relying on philanthropy, or you're not quite there yet?
It'll be some time. And going back, you know, we're helping 600 out of what could be 50,000,
sure.
right? So 600 to thousands, we're going to need philanthropy for a long time. And Lighthouse Works is still, you know, in that startup area where it's, you know, we're 7-8 years old. Mm-hmm. We're building our business. We're now, we've got an annual budget a little over $7 million, just under $8 million. We have a commercial call center that's full today. We've got 41 agents in that.
And is that the bulk of what you do?
Well, I'd say that from a revenue standpoint, the bulk of what we do is in our supply chain division where we do supply medical supplies to the federal government for the Combat Lifesaver Kit and other mm-hmm. Branches of the military. We do commercial LED lighting for Orange County, Florida. We actually build up to 160,000 Magic Band boxes for Walt Disney Company every month. So we're always doing that work. And then we have digital accessibility services. You know, the litigation around ADA compliance online versus in brick-and-mortar mm-hmm. Establishments is skyrocketing. We are consistently now getting contacts from legal firms who are defending their customer because someone went to their retailer, for instance, website, and it was not accessible, and so they're suing them. And it's being increasingly judged in the courts as an ADA violation. Mm-hmm. So our team, led by our senior accessibility analyst, Mike Fox, who's blind, and he's our senior software developer, we go in and we will perform audits on websites and issue a comprehensive report. And this is why the attorneys are calling us, is because our reporting is so comprehensive that it's kind of demonstrating due diligence on the part of their client mm-hmm. in the courts, and it's a favorable ruling for them in a lot of cases. And we'll provide that report with code level. This is where it's not accessible. Here's why, and here's how to fix it. Mm-hmm. And if they fix it, we will do another audit and then certify that website as accessible. And we have a site seal we can issue to that company. And it's sort of like the Better Housekeeping seal of approval, you know. And it says this website is certified accessible by analysts who are blind or visually impaired.
I want to go back to Lighthouse Works in a moment because mm-hmm. it sounds like you've got a lot of things going on there. But let me just dig deeper a bit into this idea of ADA compliance, because there has been reporting on so-called drive-by lawsuits.
It's predatory.
Right. Sure. Somebody will go to a business and say, you don't have the right kind of access or the right kind of railing for somebody who you know, might be in a wheelchair or has some other level of disability.
Sure.
And they'll sue them. Is it similar to what's happening with websites? Or
very similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So folks will basically swim the website, look for a website that's not accessible. And keep in mind, this is ADA compliance for any disability. It's not just blind. Mm-hmm. Just so happens that's, you know, our bailiwick. But yeah, so they'll find a web. Winn-Dixie is a great example. Someone could not access the same service that I could as a sighted person online mm-hmm. that you can also access when you go into Winn-Dixie. And they were sued down in Miami, and it's been a massive problem for them. So it is being increasingly treated like you didn't have a ramp or a handrail, to your point. Our typical customers are people, one, a business owner who is seeing this and saying, hey, I want to check my website and make sure it's accessible. Mm-hmm. Actually, three populations. Then you have attorneys who are defending people, right, who've been sued. And then you have really forward-thinking digital agencies who are building websites, like High Forge here in Orlando is a good example. Mm-hmm. Scott Mann and his team, where they take ADA very, they take it very seriously, and they want to not only protect their customers, but they also believe that the right way to do it, the prudent way to build a website, is to make sure it's accessible to all. Mm-hmm. And so they've been becoming a great partner for us in that as well. So those are really the three cases we're seeing. Mm-hmm. But we are trending up with legal teams reaching out to us.
Back to Lighthouse Works, if you are working on supply chain, you're working on lighting, packaging, that's a bunch of different kind of areas to have expertise in. How do you keep all that together? Because oftentimes a company would specialize in one thing, get good at that. You're sort of trying to have a bunch of different things on the go at once. How do you make sure that everything is done to the right standard?
Well, you do. You start with a good team, mm-hmm. you know, and without the team we have, we'd be in big trouble. In National Industries for the Blind, which is a big organization, who they administered the Ability One program, a federal program coming from the 30s that says a portion of federal contracts should be allocated to businesses that are creating employment for people who are blind. And, you know, they're you know, over 100, but I'd say 60 to 70 who are really producing. And if you look at them, and some of them are $250 million a year companies, mm-hmm. manufacturing over 25 independent different parts. Lighthouse Seattle manufactures 7,000 or so parts on a Boeing 747
really?
With blind workforce.
Huh.
If you look at a warfighter in the field of battle, nearly everything they're wearing or that's dangling off them that isn't a weapon was manufactured by the blind. All the way down to the plastic, you know, utensils they're using when they're in the field in Afghanistan. So if you look at the business models, though, they succeed by diversification. Mm-hmm. So to your point, we are not going to grow by just having a couple silos and growing those silos. The way that we grow blind industries is by having a bunch of silos. And obviously, you want to gain some market share. Mm-hmm. But it's all about that diversification.
And then how many people do you have working at Lighthouse Works?
Lighthouse total, we've got 109 between the two organizations, and I'd say roughly 60 mm-hmm. at Lighthouse Works, and the majority are blind or visually impaired. And I want to make a point here, too, that at Lighthouse Works, we've got, you know, over half of those employees are blind. They are absolutely no different category of employee than I am. Every single employee at Lighthouse Works got their job the same way I did, resume, interviewing, qualifying for the job, mm-hmm. and upholding our core values. So this isn't a work program or a training program. These are real career opportunities for people who are blind with upward mobility and benefits just like me. And that's a really important component to what we're doing here in Central Florida.
Let me ask you this then. I mean, Kyle Johnson, you say there's scope to expand your footprint. You want to help more people in Central Florida. There are many more folks who need some help.
Yes.
Is part of that mission to try and grow the footprint of Lighthouse Works? Like, do you have a goal to expand the workforce by a certain number by the end of 2019, say?
Well, we have a 2023 goal, September 30, 2023. We want to be employing over 250 people. We want to have at least double the amount of people we're serving at Lighthouse Central Florida to 1,200.
That's pretty ambitious.
It's very ambitious. You know, if you talk to our board chairman and the rest of our board and the rest of our team, we want to and will be the largest employer of the blind and visually impaired in the southeastern United States. That's the real goal.
Mm-hmm.
Because every time we, you know, every inch we make towards that goal, we are turning people who are here today relying on our community, our economy, into people who are contributing to it. And more importantly, people who are tired of out being in the community and people thinking they're incapable of anything. And so many of them are not counted as unemployed anymore because they've quit trying.
Hmm.
And these are people that are getting a call and saying, I have your resume here. Would you like to come down and talk? And getting a job in our commercial call center, Foresight 360 call center, and launching into careers, you know, where they're, you know, before they know it, they're a lead and they have the opportunity to move into management and come off of, you know, Social Security insurance for one, and take a more independent swing at their life in a company that believes in them and provides them the process, technology, and training to be successful.
Do you have a lot of veterans employed at Lighthouse Works, or are a lot of the folks you help veterans?
We see veterans from time to time at Lighthouse Central Florida, although the VA does have a residential program
mm-hmm.
that is accessible to them through their status as a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
We have not many veterans working for us, and that's something we'd like to see change. I've got a big appetite for that because, you know, not only are they blind, but they served our country. So that's something that we're very interested in exploring. How can we better promote these job opportunities among veterans who are blind.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask about you. Why did you move to this field, and why Lighthouse in particular? Because this is a career change for you, right?
It was a big career change. Yeah, 5-6 years ago, I was in wealth management. Had never, ever known anyone who was blind or visually impaired. Didn't know anything about it. It's a bit of a story to tell you how this happened, but it was sort of started with being voluntold that I was going to help start a young executives committee at Lighthouse Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
But I was looking for purpose and meaning, and I wasn't finding it, and I didn't know where to find it. And in Lighthouse, what I saw when I got there was creating measurable impact in people's lives, right? It's not just doing good to feel good. It's actually at Lighthouse Central Florida, you can see where a child starts with us at 6 months old. And when they're five, they're in mainstream kindergarten in a classroom full of kids with no disabilities, and they're succeeding. Or at Lighthouse Works, you know, to see the dedication of our workforce. You know, in a commercial call center, you have attrition rates of 50, 60% easily.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is below 10%, probably below 5%. This workforce is so dedicated, and it provides us with these competitive advantages that we would not simply have access to if they weren't blind, right? And so, and then to see
that partly because they don't have as many opportunities outside
sure.
of what you provide?
Sure. But the other end of that side of that coin is when seven out of 10 of your peers are unemployed and you aren't, you tend to really appreciate your job.
Sure.
You work at a place who, and we aren't the only provider of employment for people who are blind. We wish everybody would do it, but we believe we're the preferred first provider of employment because of our savviness on the tech side and the accommodations. But it's that. It's they're in a work environment that also has a lot of their peers in there. They're respected and treated like equals at our place of employment and given opportunities to succeed. So, you know, it's a combination of things, you know. But our culture is second to none. You know, our supply chain employees in the warehouse, they make over minimum wage, right? Minimum wage or above. They're not high earners at the entry-level position. But they have three times now designed and paid to have screen printed their own T-shirts with team slogans on them just because they're so proud of their team and the work that they do. And then the final piece of that, if you go in the warehouse and you ask, how many of you got help at Lighthouse Central Florida? Nearly every one of them are going to raise their hand, and they know that the box they're building, the medical supplies that they're labeling and shipping are not only helping our troops, but it's creating revenue that's going to be there to help the next person that walks through the door at Lighthouse Central Florida. So it's their way of paying it forward. You know, there's this broader mission to our business than P&L, than creating revenue for shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Kyle Johnson, obviously with the passing of President George H.W. Bush, you know, one of the things he's noted for, of course, is helping to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act. Some years on from that now, what more work do you think is left to be done to further the cause of folks with disabilities in the United States?
Well, we've got a long way to go. You know, when I have a capable employee who's owned and operated his own businesses in the past, who's very intelligent and capable, goes to dinner, and the waitress comes up, and it's not malicious, but she comes up and she asks his wife what he's going to eat.
Mm.
That demonstrates that humanity gap. I don't see a person. I find it fascinating, in fact, how they're the ones that are blind, but we're the ones that don't see them. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've actually got a big marketing campaign that just kicked off, WeSeeWhat'sPossible.org. And on that is really to break down those barriers to inclusion, to help break down, to close that gap for people. You'll see ads like, I lost my sight, not my strength, or not my sense of adventure, or not my ambition. And trying to create a platform for people to see that not only are these people that we should help, but they're people that are capable and valuable. And we also give visitors an opportunity at the bottom of that page, you know, WeSeeWhat'sPossible.org, to sign a pledge that says that I'm going to have this in mind and I'm not going to fall into those barriers such as being uncomfortable or issuing stigma. If we can help, and Central Florida, that's where we'll focus today, but we got a lot of work across the country. But if we can be aware of the stigmas and the misperceptions, right, and the fears that carry, because I simply don't know what's possible with folks, if we can get people to be aware of that, then when they'll begin to see a person with all these attributes who happens to be blind, and then hopefully we can blow the lid off of that, and people, businesses in this community, for one, can recognize the valuable asset they have in this workforce, many of whom are parked idle on the sidelines, and they are chomping at the bit to contribute, you know, not to speak of basic respect. You know, mm-hmm. I think you, Matthew, if you woke up tomorrow and you had 20% of your ability to see, where did the rest of you go? It's still there. And imagine now you are you in the community. You're now blind. And most people don't think you're capable of anything. And you're overlooked.
Mm-hmm.
And you're out of sight, right? You're an invisible now. That would be a travesty, right? And I share that with you. So this isn't about feeling sorry for people. It's about maybe taking a look at myself and going, you know, I've really overlooked this population. And I can say that from my heart because that was me 5-6 years ago. I didn't think a person who's blind, I didn't know what they're capable of, but I do now.
Kyle Johnson is the incoming CEO of Lighthouse Central Florida. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having us, Matt.
Still to come, the State Board of Education's pick for Commissioner of Education is raising the alarm in some quarters. We'll take a closer look at what Richard Corcoran's appointment to the role means for Florida's public education system when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida's new education commissioner is Richard Corcoran. The appointment of the former Speaker of the Florida House of Representatives to the role is drawing some criticism. His support for the expansion of charter schools is raising alarm from teachers' unions. Yet at least one member of the State Board of Education, which voted unanimously yesterday in favor of the appointment, said he was satisfied Corcoran would support traditional public schools. From the Education Desk this week, we check in with reporter Ryan Daly from our sister station WFSU in Tallahassee about what Corcoran's appointment signifies for the Department of Education. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks, Matthew, for having me. Appreciate it.
So there have been some critics of Richard Corcoran's appointment as the Education Commissioner. One of them is that he doesn't really have a background in education compared to, say, the outgoing Education Commissioner Pam Stewart. Why do his supporters say he's the right person for this job?
Yeah, I mean, we at the state board meeting, we heard from a number of detractors and supporters. And, you know, I think what you heard, the common thread from the supporters that you heard, that Corcoran's leadership style is something that they really like, that they see in him. Knowing how to run an organization is, you know, what one person in particular said, and you heard from some of his proponents talking about how effective he made the Florida House of Representatives during his time as Speaker, in their opinion. And, you know, I guess from, you know, to take the overarching message of his supporters, I guess they think that he'll bring that to Florida DOE and really kind of take charge of the priorities he's setting for his agenda out the gate, which, you know, in his words, are pretty much mirror what Governor-elect Ron DeSantis, you know, wants.
And I suppose we should note, too, that Richard Corcoran was at one point, well, his name at least had been floated as a potential candidate for governor. So in some ways, it's not too surprising to see him appear in some role in this incoming government for the state of Florida.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, actually, there was a press conference in Tallahassee at one point when Richard Corcoran announced that he wouldn't be running and would be kind of letting then-candidate Adam Putnam put his hat into the ring. That Corcoran said he would not oppose that, and they gave a press conference side by side. I think people who watched the goings-on at the Capitol could probably have guessed that Richard Corcoran's name wouldn't be going away.
So what have we heard from Richard Corcoran about how he might shape education policy as commissioner? And you alluded to it a little bit in answering that first question, Ryan Daly, saying that his agenda aligns pretty closely with what we're hearing from Governor-elect Ron DeSantis.
One of the first questions, actually, I believe the first question Corcoran was asked in a press gaggle immediately after the meeting is, you know, what's top on your priority list? He answers questions very directly. That's you know, he just launched straight into, you know, he really shares the vision of Ron DeSantis. And, you know, to quote from him, he says DeSantis has talked about increasing opportunities in vocational education. He's talked about increasing choice options, improving curriculum, reevaluating standards, and in his words, making sure that we get 80% of dollars into the classroom so the children benefit, is what he told reporters. That's something that I think is fairly bipartisan just as a viewpoint. I think a lot of people want to see less spending on high-level positions in lieu of actually pumping that money into the classroom. I've heard that from both sides of the aisle. But yeah, that is something that Corcoran and DeSantis as well are saying that is a priority.
Well, let's dig in, if we could, in a little more detail, Ryan Daly, into the issue of school choice, because this has been a controversial thing, and some of detractors or the critics of this particular selection of Richard Corcoran as education commissioner, that is one of the things they are worried about, this idea of expanding school choice. Tell us a little bit about the background to that controversy.
Corcoran was asked about it a number of times. Notably, Richard Corcoran's wife, Ann Corcoran, founded a charter school a number of years ago, and also is currently sitting on the board of a charter school that is set to open up this year in Tallahassee, called Tallahassee Classical School. And, you know, if you take that in tandem with just actual words of support for school choice, and I mean, it's no secret, Richard Corcoran and his wife don't intend to make it a secret that they support school choice. Some of the questions that Corcoran was asked about it are, you know, have you benefited financially? Has your wife benefited financially from these associations with charter schools? And his answer unequivocally is absolutely not. I believe his quote was never a penny, not in any way, in directly or indirectly. So if you take Corcoran at his word, I mean, it's a complete passion project for him and his wife. But I mean, the questions as to conflict of interests are things that will linger. I think he will continually be pressed on that. In fact, it's kind of interesting talking about the Tallahassee Classical School. They were actually denied their charter by our local school board. And when that happens, the appeal goes up to the State Board of Education. So Corcoran was asked by a reporter, you know, if essentially an identical situation came up where a charter school that his wife was involved with, you know, let's say in a hypothetical, had their charter denied and the appeal gets kicked up to the state board, what are you going to do about that being seen as a conflict of interest. And Corcoran said, you know, he was pretty general and vague, but said we would follow the law, like, you know, we would follow the legal procedures that are in place. So, I mean, the questions on that front are just starting, and they're certainly not going to go away. But I mean, that's the gist of the background, is that Corcoran and his wife, and he said today in the meeting that he sends his kids to a charter school, and charter schools are public schools. So he's very careful to say that they go to a public school, albeit a charter public school. In the same breath, Corcoran also reminds people that he is a product of traditional public schools. And, you know, if you take him at his word, he's saying that he wants to do what's best for both. But your public education advocates, like the Florida Education Association, for instance, they are voicing displeasure, as they have. But I think, you know, one thing that I guess, depending on where you stand, could be encouraging. The FEA president, Frederick Ingram, was at the meeting today. And, you know, after the meeting, he said, you know, they're disappointed that there wasn't a nationwide search. And, you know, he's wary of Corcoran's ideas on education. But the two shook hands. They said that they would be working together. Mr. Ingram said he was going to make it a point to work with Corcoran for the good of students. And actually, Corcoran said that he will be at the next FEA meeting.
So it sounds like there are some signs of at least some willingness to see what Richard Corcoran sort of brings to the table from the union's perspective as well. Just on that issue, though, of, you know, maybe some of the concerns people have about somebody who's so pro-charter school being appointed education commissioner, there was a recent report from a nonpartisan research group, Integrity Florida, and it found that one of the things it found, quote, lax regulation of charter schools has created opportunities for financial mismanagement and criminal corruption, end quote. Did we hear anything from critics at the hearing about this, what may be a heavier emphasis on advocacy for charter schools as the education department sort of moves forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what you hear uniformly from critics of Corcoran, is that they are worried that the scales are going to be tipped in favor of charter schools when it comes to, you know, support from DOE and more broadly on the legislative level. I mean, the argument from critics of the charter school system, one of the arguments is that charter schools don't have to play by the same rules as traditional public schools. And I think the fear is that with a direct injection of support for charter schools at the highest post at DOE is going to lead to, you know, just this explosion of charter schools throughout the state. And I mean, I think it's too early to tell before we start seeing some of the moves that are made, you know, to tell if that's going to be imminent, if that's going to be absolutely the case. I mean, like I said before, charter applications are done at the local school board level. But if they're denied, that appeal goes right up to DOE. And in the case of just like we saw last year in Tallahassee, our local board denied a charter and it was ultimately accepted and they're going to be opening up pretty soon here. So I think Corcoran will have a willingness to work with both of these sides, but there's definitely some uneasiness, you know, amongst those who feel that, you know, dollars by way of students in the seats are being removed from traditional public schools because they're in increasingly more numbers going to charters. You definitely heard that, and that argument certainly is not going anywhere.
One more question, Ryan Daly, and you might have alluded to it before as well, but was there any indication in this hearing that Richard Corcoran might support the idea of increasing teachers' salary?
So Corcoran was asked directly about whether he was open to looking at teacher salaries. And he says he is open to giving that a look. I don't know what that means for a potential increase. He also talked about the legislative budget request for education. He said he's going to be having a conversation with outgoing Commissioner Pam Stewart in these next days before he actually takes the post, to work out if there's going to be any changes in that, because I believe that was published in September. So that budget request for this upcoming session. So that might be something to watch, whether the legislative budget request changes at all. Yeah, that's just going to be something that we're going to have to wait and watch. But if you take Corcoran at his word, he is open to looking at it. So definitely something to watch as we're coming up on session in March.
Ryan Daly is a reporter with WFSU in Tallahassee covering the confirmation hearing for Richard Corcoran, the incoming Commissioner of Education for the state of Florida. Ryan, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, Matthew. Really appreciate it.
Still to come, a wildlife hospital and sanctuary in Palm Shores cares for about 5,000 patients a year. We pay a visit to the sanctuary when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Florida Wildlife Hospital and Sanctuary in Palm Shores cares for about 5,000 patients a year. The Brevard County nonprofit's mission is to aid injured, sick, and orphaned native Florida wildlife and migratory birds. When they're all healed up, staff and volunteers return them to the wild. The hospital takes in bats, flying squirrels, seabirds such as pelicans, possums, raccoons, bobcats, and lots of baby songbirds, among other animals. Last December, 90.7's Crystal Chavez paid a visit to the sanctuary and talked to the executive director, Tracy Frampton.
Well, we are here to help residents and citizens that find injured native wildlife. Sometimes it gets a little confusing because we are not permitted to release non-native wildlife. So there's only certain things we can work with, but it's a lot. So when somebody finds a baby bird that fell out of a nest or a baby squirrel or a pelican that's entangled in monofilament, they can call us up. A lot of times the babies are actually better if you can put them back with their moms. We do an awesome job, but we ain't mom. So many times there is an opportunity to put them back. So we do try and coach people on how to do it. It is a myth that if you touch the animal, mom won't come back. That is not true. So that is, especially in the spring, we'll be doing a lot of coaching, trying to get people to put the babies back with their mother. The monofilament situation is a totally different situation. The animal is not going to be able to get untangled from fishing line. So the best thing is to get them in here as soon as they can. We do see about 5,000 patients a year. So we have a lot of patients coming through our doors, and we never charge for someone to drop an animal off.
And I saw the drop box outside. Tell me a little bit about how that works. Is that for after hours?
Yes, absolutely. When we're here, come on in. If somebody's not right at the front desk, there's a little doorbell you ring. Come on in. The more details we can get about the situation that happened with the animal, the better. So come on in, talk to us, let us know what happened. However, you don't just find things from 9 to 4:30 every day. So if you find something in the middle of the night, bring it in. If it's in a little cardboard box that fits in our drop-off boxes, leave it in the box. That's absolutely fine. There's a little mailbox there with paperwork if you could fill out some information so that we could contact you if you have more questions. And those are checked throughout the night.
You mentioned some of the types of animals, but can you give me a bigger full list?
Sure. We are really permitted to work with anything that is native to Florida, except we can't do marine mammals. As you'll see when you walk around, we don't have a setup for manatees and dolphins. We do not do sea turtles. We are not allowed to rehab alligators or venomous snakes. We do not get many venomous snakes or alligators in here. However, we do get sea turtles pretty regularly, and we will take them, but then we immediately transport them to wherever we're told to take them to. But pretty much anything else that is native to Florida, we do bats, flying squirrels, seabirds such as pelicans, terns, gulls. We do possums, raccoons, bobcats, and lots of baby songbirds.
There's a photo of a little squirrel on your Facebook page that says you have to get creative when feeding some of your patients as they get older and more feisty. What are some examples?
Well, that was a good example. Sometimes the squirrels come in and they're old enough that they don't like people, which is really what we want. We want these patients to not like us. That is the way it should be, because then we know they're going to make it in the wild. If they start liking us and reaching out to us for food, then they're probably not going to have as much success in the wild. So when that happens, then we've got to, you know, watch our fingers and protect ourselves. And so that was a perfect example of the kind of feeding him where he was instead of pulling him out. Usually with the baby mammals, they're weighed every morning. So he's, at some point, you're going to have to handle him. But if he's getting four feedings a day and he's really feisty, then there are ways to feed them without actually handling them. Because, of course, we want staff and volunteers to be safe.
So y'all do x-rays on site?
We do. We just recently got an x-ray machine. We've been without an x-ray machine for about 4 years. And as you can imagine, they're very expensive. We could have found one that is the old style, kind of like the old film camera. But we really wanted to move to the modern age. So we did find a reasonably priced, used x-ray machine that was in great shape and came with a great warranty. That was one of the other issues, is finding them with good warranties. It came with a great warranty. So on October 31st, we got our x-ray machine, and it has been used multiple times every day since.
So how do you get a wild animal to stay still enough for an x-ray?
Oh, good question. Yeah, you can't just say, hold still. So we usually use anesthesia. Just some gas is typically how we do it, and then get them in position where we need them. Kind of, if it's a bird, kind of hold the wings out. We do not want to expose staff to unnecessary amounts of radiation, so we can use tape or different things to kind of hold the animal in position so that the staff can step out, take the x-ray, and then walk back in. And it is a DR system, which means it immediately shows up right on the computer. So if you got a bad x-ray, you can immediately do it again.
So what are the types of things y'all do too, aside from feeding and x-raying? Like, what other types of things go into care?
It really depends. It depends on the season. Like for the seabirds, a lot of times they're, once they get really weak, then internal parasites take over. So we give them parasite treatments. We might give them antibiotics, especially if they have fish hooks in them. There is a way to actually get a fish hook out of a bird if it swallowed it. It doesn't always work, but what we do here is we take cotton and we stuff it inside the fish that they're going to eat, the frozen fish, put cotton in it, and when the fish is digested, the cotton is left in the digestive system, and as it passes out, oftentimes it will hook the hook, snag it, and it passes it all out. So they don't do well with surgery. You wouldn't want to do surgery on a seabird to get the hook out. So that's one way we can do it. And again, that's awesome that we have the x-ray machine, because then we can kind of follow it along and see if it's moving, if it comes out. So those kinds of things, antibiotics, we can do parasite treatments. Some wing injuries, we are able to put a bandage and a sling on it or whatever, and bird bones heal fairly quickly, and hopefully they heal properly, but they do, because they're hollow, they heal fairly quickly. So there are a lot of times you can wrap things. Sometimes it's a eye injury that just takes time to heal. Sometimes it's a window strike. Some of those migratory birds are coming through and they hit a window and they just need a couple of days to recover, and we can release them. And then there's a lot of the babies that we're raising.
Based on what you see, do you have any advice for people to prevent some of these injuries?
Absolutely. That's an excellent question. So for the fishing line, please just pick up your fishing line. If you get snagged on something, take the time and effort to go try and reel it in, cut it off the bush or wherever it ended up, because that is a real problem. Another thing is for windows, it's actually better if you have a bird feeder that you like to watch the birds. It's better to actually have it closer to your window than farther away, because if it's farther away and something startles the bird, it has more of a running start and can hurt itself. Where if it's really close to the window, it's so close it doesn't have enough time to build up speed to injure itself. Picking up trash is another huge one. Please recycle. A lot of these animals are ingesting trash. Balloons are a really bad thing, especially if they have a long string attached. A lot of animals think it's something to eat, and they will eat it, and it can cause real problems.
So what about when the animal is ready to go, it's all healed up? What's the process for getting them back out?
So when they're in the hospital building itself, they're really in the more critical stage. when they are recovered well enough, they also need to build up their strength again. So we have outdoor enclosures that we put them in, and depending on the animal, it might be out there for a couple of weeks, it might be out there a month or so. And we do not want to release them until we feel like they really are ready to survive back in the wild, because it's a tough world out there. So we let them build up their muscles, make sure they're able to catch food. And then we have another great use of our volunteers, which is like the best part of this job, is they will transport the animals and release them. Many of the animals we try and release back where they were found. Some of them it's required by law. You have to release them within a mile of where they were found. If they were adults with a breeding territory, we definitely try and get them back near where they were found. If they were young, they're not going to know where they are anyway, so it's not quite as critical. But we do have a great, sometimes staff will do it, sometimes volunteers will do it, but we take them back and let them go again.
Have you ever got like attached to one of your patients and it's hard to let them go?
It is at times, but we all know that that's really the best thing for the animals, is to get them back in the wild. So as much as it's hard, it's also a celebration to see them go again. Now, we do get some animals occasionally that are not releasable. Some of the more common species, unfortunately, it's hard to find them a captive home. But sometimes there are species that we are able to find them a captive home, some zoos, education facilities. So we do reach out to our friends when we have an animal that seems to have adapted well to captivity and is a species that they might be interested in. We definitely try and find them some captive homes where they can be an ambassador to teach people about their species.
Yeah, tell me more. You said you have some ambassadors on site. Who are they and what do they do, really?
Yes, we do. We've got some owls and hawks. We've got a few reptiles, and they go to programs. We do go do school programs. We go to festivals. We will even occasionally, if somebody wants to see something and we have time and they're here, we can bring an animal out. There's also cages out front where we occasionally put the animals so people can just walk in and see them. Some of our owls have double duty. They do education programs, but they also help raise babies. And the two that we use for this are both males. We have a screech owl who is an awesome foster dad, and we have a great horned owl who we've started using with kind of a little bit older babies, not the little itty bitties. And we do have video of both of them feeding the babies. They're really handleable animals until they get babies, and then they become dad and they don't like us, and it's really interesting to watch the transition. But it really helps teach the babies how to be an owl and how to not like us, and that's what we want.
Wow, and so they'll just take to these babies naturally?
Yeah, it's really amazing to watch. They will take to the babies very well. The only thing that we really have to make sure that these babies are able to catch live food before we release them. If a hawk or an owl comes in as an adult, we know they can catch food. They're an adult. But when the babies come in, they've never had to catch live food. So part of their training process is, we call it mouse school, and they have to learn how to catch live food. It may sound really mean for the poor little mouse, and I get that, but it also would be really cruel to release something in the wild that does not know how to eat.
That was Tracy Frampton, Executive Director of the Florida Wildlife Hospital.
And that interview first aired on Intersection in December 2017. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Production assistance for this week's show from Emily Lang. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.